Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
This episode is also brought to you by Chris Salee, your local health markets insurance agency. Creative solutions for your health, Medicare, and life insurance needs. Personalized advice at 503-678-5768. Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey friends, and welcome to this episode of the Canby Current. I'm James Walton. Let's read the news. Though the Book Nook has moved multiple times since it first opened in downtown Canby in 2017, you could always find it somewhere in the Graham Building on the corner of Grant Street and Northwest 2nd. But that's about to change. Come January, the independent bookseller will be moving across the street to an 1,850 square foot commercial space inside the Caldera Building, formerly known as Parsons Canby Pharmacy. It's exciting, but bittersweet, said Book Nook owner and operator Megan Waterman. Our current landlords have been incredibly supportive and encouraging from the very beginning of our journey, having been themselves booksellers in the past, and we are sad to be leaving them. That said, the Watermans are excited to be working with Caldera owner Daniel Godfrey and to be moving into a building that holds such a special place in the hearts of many longtime Canby residents. We know there is a lot of nostalgia with this particular location and hope that we can honor that by keeping the space alive with gifts and books and community, Waterman said. Little known fact, the display counters in the Book Nook are originally from Parsons Pharmacy and Gifts. With this move, they'll be returning home. The new space is about 500 square feet larger than the bookstore's current location and, she believes, offers better visibility for a retail enterprise. Yeah, the biggest complaint we hear from new customers is how hard it is finding us hiding on the backside of our current building, Waterman explained. We believe in the vision of a healthy, vibrant, small town downtown, and we want to be part of making that vision a reality. The new space, however, does need some work. The Book Nook hopes to replace the Parsons Building original entrance on Grant Street, as well as add more windows, a bathroom, new lighting, and shelving. The store is asking for support from the community via a GoFundMe campaign. The community has long been a steadfast supporter of the independently owned store, which started out as quite literally a Book Nook, a tiny footprint of unused space at the Graham Building, with the cash register located under the stairs, like in Harry Potter, Waterman notes. Many of our customers have offered to help us over the years, emotionally, physically, and financially, she said. We know this growth, especially during a pandemic, would not be possible without the absolutely amazing support of our customers shopping and keeping us going. Oregon Governor Kate Brown on Tuesday extended her emergency declaration regarding the COVID-19 pandemic for an additional 60 days, until January 2, 2021. The declaration is the legal underpinning for her COVID-19 executive orders and the Oregon Health Authority's health and safety guidance. The governor reviews and reevaluates the emergency declaration and related executive orders every 60 days. The last time she extended the state of emergency for 60 days, its expiration coincidentally fell on November 3rd, Election Day. The news comes amid a surge of new cases of the novel coronavirus in Oregon, including a new daily record that was set last week with 550 new cases. More than 600 Oregonians have died from complications related to COVID-19. Extending the COVID-19 state of emergency is not something I do lightly, but we all know too well that not taking action would mean an even greater loss of life, Brown said in a statement. The second wave of COVID-19 has arrived in the United States, and this time it is hitting all of our communities. In the statement, Brown urged Oregonians to continue to follow the standard public health guidance of frequent hand washing, wearing face coverings while in public, maintaining physical distance, staying home when sick, and avoiding social get-togethers, especially indoors. My goal is to keep Oregon on track to open more schools for in-person instruction for our students, and to continue to reopen and keep open our businesses, communities, and economies, the governor said. Oregon is not an island. Without safety precautions in place, we could quickly see our case count spike as well. The state of emergency declaration is the legal underpinning for the executive orders Brown has issued throughout the pandemic, including those governing the operations of businesses, childcare, schools, and higher education. Extending the state of emergency declaration allows those orders to stay in effect. Being a county rich in farms and other agricultural resources, the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office is no stranger to calls involving livestock. Typically, though, they do not happen in residential neighborhoods. However, that was the case early Tuesday morning as deputies were called to a residential subdivision in unincorporated Milwaukee on the report of a loose donkey. Deputies arrived around 4:30 a.m. and found the donkey, but the sheriff's office said a dog from another house got loose and chased it away. The donkey was found again on a different street, along with its owner. Deputies said the donkey sustained slight injuries from the episode, but will be okay. Officers provided a rope, and the owner was able to walk the donkey back home. I guess you could say they really saved his ass. Facing a season already beset by challenges, the Canby Cougar football team chose not to punt on their most popular annual fundraiser, Cougar Cards. The $25 cards, which offers hundreds of dollars in discounts to a wide variety of local restaurants and stores, are typically sold door to door, with prizes being offered to the players who move the most plastic. For obvious reasons, that wasn't going to be a possibility this year. We're not selling door to door for the safety of players and our community, explains head football coach Jimmy Joyce. This is the first year we have sold online. Each kid has an app and we'll be contacting people to purchase. The numbers are important because, hey, this is still football and the stats matter. Players will still earn prizes based on how many cards they sell, from 10, a free Dutch Bros drink and Canby Cougar branded neck gaiter, to 50, a $100 Nike gift card. The Cougar Cards are by far the team's biggest fundraiser, Joyce tells The Current, raising around $20,000 each year, which goes towards new uniforms, helmets, and more. It all goes back to the kids in one way or another, he said. And with limited fundraising opportunities because of COVID this year, card sales are more important than ever. Despite having to alter their sales strategy, the team is hopeful for their prospects this year, simply because the Cougar Cards are amazingly popular in Canby. Door-to-door or not, they pretty much sell themselves. Oh, it's amazing the support we receive, says Coach Joyce. I get at least 5 emails a week asking me about when they go on sale. Our athletic secretary, Heather Britt, probably gets even more. This edition of Now Hear This Sports is brought to you by Reif and Hunsicker, PC. When you need an attorney, turn to the firm Canby has trusted for over 50 years. Call Reif and Hunsicker today at 503-266-3456. The Canby Rebels 10U softball team took home first place in their bracket of the NAFA Halloween Scream Tournament this weekend, defeating the Showtime Navy from Battleground, Washington, 10-8. But that's not the most impressive part. They did it all while rocking awesome unis inspired by the Rockford Peaches of history and the 1992 hit film, A League of Their Own. Head coach James Heckathorn said the team's homage to the Peaches and the other athletes of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League came as part of a series of lessons about the women of Cooperstown who inspired the film and broke barriers for women in professional sports. I loved learning about the history of girls playing baseball because they made softball, said one of the players, Brooklyn Brady, age 9. They showed the boys that girls can play too. I think I could play in a dress for a whole season. It was fun. I felt lucky to be on this team and to be able to dress up with my teammates and spend time with them, learning about all these amazing girl baseball players, agreed Presley Rixker, also 9. I want to beat Sophie Curry's stolen base record. Nicknamed the Flint Flash, she was originally from Flint, Michigan, and Tina Cobb, Curry's was a 4-time AAGPBL All-Star and the league's all-time leader in stolen bases, as well as a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame. Curry's was virtually unstoppable once she got on base, stealing at least one base 80% of the time. Her record of 201 stolen bases in a single season has never been touched, not even by the legendary Ricky Henderson, who holds the Major League Baseball record of 130. But hey, records were meant to be broken, right? We're pulling for you, Presley. I love that the girls never gave up, said Abby Morrow, age 10, of the Rockford Peaches, even when there were no fans. The Canby Rebels faced a similar challenge, though for very different reasons. Strict crowd limits were in effect due to the continuing coronavirus pandemic, and the girls had to observe strict mask guidelines and other restrictions implemented by the NAFA. Reflecting on the experience, Coach Heckathorn, or Coach James as he prefers, said that coaching youth sports is more than just teaching how to swing and catch, it's also about teaching life lessons. That's a responsibility both Coach Monk and I take to heart, he said. Giving these girls opportunities to make memories that will last a lifetime and something positive to look back on when they're asked about COVID in 2020. We've been pretty lucky to get to play, and I hope to see more kids getting back to sports soon. For photos on the story, visit our website, canbyfirst.com.
Hey, Frankie, do you ever wonder why some businesses aren't like more transparent?
Oh, yeah. Like, some of the old buildings downtown are so dark. Get some more windows,
no,
you know?
No. I mean, like, transparent, as in being open and honest about their business practices.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, DirectLink is a good example. They don't have internet data caps or charge extra fees for high usage.
Oh, yeah. Which is great with all the internet I've been using since this whole COVID situation started.
They also don't charge infrastructure build fees like some other providers. And they're active in our community, too. Check out their philanthropic efforts at directlink.coop/community.
Did you know that they also hold an annual meeting every year where members can talk directly with the board of directors and upper management?
Talk about transparent. You won't see any other companies being that accessible. DirectLink really is here for us. Call 503-266-8111 or visit directlink.coop to learn more today.
All right, joining us on the Canby conversation today, back onto our show, are Ken and Melinda Buckles of Remembering America's Heroes. Hi, guys.
Hi. Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you guys are here to tell us a little bit about a big project of Ken's this year, which is a new book called Remembrance.
Yes. Yeah, Remembrance Volume 1, Remembering...
Volume one.
Remembering my veteran friends and guests from Living History Days.
Wow. So tell us a little bit about it, and maybe in doing that, for folks who don't know, a little bit about your work, which obviously informs this book.
Yeah, I started a program at Milwaukee High in 1996 called Living History Day, and I got to give credit to Ackerman Middle School. I attended their first one the year before, in 95, and was so excited by it, took the idea to Milwaukee High, and little did I know it would just explode into something that, going on 25 years later, we're still doing. Well, we would bring the veterans into the high school to talk to the students about their experiences. And the first chapter or section on the book is a relative of mine, Frank Woodruff Buckles, who was America's last World War I veteran. Mm-hmm. The rest of Volume 1 is all World War II veterans that I became friends with, got to know really well, and developed very close friendships with them, and they started to open up to me more and more as the years went on, and I kept recording the stories, and 22 years after starting this project, Volume 1 is finished and out there.
Only took 22 years, huh? Well, I'd love to hear a little bit more about Frank Buckles, but we'll come back to that. First of all, I just wanted to ask about, you know, the reason that you have been doing this for so long. What motivates you, and what value do you see in veterans of different wars sharing their experiences and the things that they've done with our young people and students?
Well, it goes back to my father, who was a Marine in the Korean War, and I knew growing up in the late 50s and 60s that there was something different about him, and we didn't know anything about it then. I left to pursue my dream of playing college football. I knew I wanted to be a high school PE teacher and a coach, and in 1984, my father took his life, and it literally destroyed my mother. She was gave up the will to live, and at 54 years old, she died. And that just, the ripple effect with me and my little sister and brother, it's just unbelievable. And it led to this program of getting high school kids to honor and thank veterans. We don't care if you agree or disagree with the war or conflict. Many of them serve because they don't have the financial means to go on to college or whatever. And I've learned a lot that over the years that every veteran who's experienced combat, it doesn't matter what war or conflict, they come back changed and they have troubles. And so it was a chance for us to, it started a great healing process for veterans, and the awareness and education has just been phenomenal, what it's done over the years.
I think either past times that we've talked, Ken, it might have been the last time we had you on the show, but the impact that it has on veterans as well, to be able to share their stories, to have people care to hear about the things that they've done, and just to have that opportunity really has an impact on them and their health and well-being as well. Isn't that what you've seen?
Number one word is healing. I can't tell you how many, at least over 100 World War II and Korean veterans that started to get post-traumatic stress counseling because of the result of Living History Day, and many of them that are included in all the volumes of my books never talked about it before until they were in a classroom, and they would start to open up just a little bit, and that's in the book also. And I'd like to add, we wouldn't sit here right now if it wasn't for Melinda, my wife, the last 4 or 5 years getting me to finish writing this and get it edited and done. So thank you. Thank you, Melinda.
What has that been like, Melinda? How were you able to motivate? That's a lot. I mean, that is a lot. As someone who writes a lot of short articles, you know, where it's like something I experience for like a 15-minute interview and then, you know, have to write. I can't imagine trying to take 22 years and have to go to the page and put it down. So
yeah, it's been great. I used to tell people he was a walking encyclopedia, and he definitely knows the dates and the names and the occurrences. So there are veterans that come to him and just share from the heart about what happened in the war, where they won't talk to anyone else about it. And he had these stories, and they need to get out. They really need to get out, and people need to know what they go through when they go to war. It's important.
So 22 years, how many volumes is this book going to be, Ken?
Well, that's a heck of a question, because as I was writing and had two different editors help us, the first one was Bob Christensen, a retired English teacher at Milwaukee, who did a fantastic job. Then my first stepson, who's a professor of English in Japan, took over the second one. And when he started formatting it, the darn thing was over 1,000 pages. So people that I'd rely on for advice, some experts in this field, said, well, no one will ever buy it. They won't even buy a book that's 500 pages long. You need to put it in volumes. So I said, wow, we've got enough finish that we can do volume one now. So volume one is Frank Buckles, World War One, and the rest, World War Two. Volume two, which should come out at the end of this winter, is the rest of World War Two and the Korean War. And I'm very happy about that, because when I do in the research, I found that the Korean War is at the bottom of the list of Americans buying books on American wars. It truly is the forgotten war, and I'm hoping that this will piggyback for them. And many of them were World War II vets who got called back and served in the Korean War. Then volume three will be Vietnam veterans, and I'm being encouraged to put a volume four on the radar screen, because I've met so many Desert Storm, Iraq, Afghanistan, Bosnia, other conflicts vets, and I says, I'm not a writer, but we'll see what the future holds. Hopefully I'll do that. Or I'll do it.
One thing that I, transitioning back to the book, and obvious, I mean, like, congratulations. You've been number one now, I think, on Amazon for 2 weeks.
Shocking.
military history category, which is amazing. But I think one thing that has led to that, and maybe I'll ask you, what do you think has contributed to that? But you have this network, obviously, that you've built here in Oregon from doing what you do for so long. But you also do this really cool thing on social media where you share the book with folks that are actually featured in it. I believe that's what you've been doing with veterans.
You know, I have veterans that I know and connections with veterans all around the United States. I knew that, you know, they'd been curious and pushing, when are you going to get this done? So I knew they'd buy it. I knew that Milwaukee High alumni would buy it, and I knew the Camby community would, people in Camby community would buy it. And I got on Facebook when I retired from teaching. Some former student athletes said, you need to get on Facebook so you can track people down. And because of it, it's led to me following all these kids I taught and coached who are now adults and with families, and some in their early 50s have grandchildren now. And for a lot, it's amazing the reminiscing of they experienced these living history days, and it's stirring up a lot of memories. Well, it was Melinda's idea to say, hey, when you get a book, take a picture of it and send it to me. And so we started posting them on Facebook, and I would give, if it was a veteran, I'd give a little information about it. And so people feel like, yeah, we're getting to know these veterans. But that was Melinda's idea, and it was a great idea, like free advertising.
Yeah. And that, you know, they're always such cute pictures of these like veterans smiling and stuff. But that's always been your thing, Melinda. When you guys were doing the Vietnam apology shirts as well, you would, I think you even got a picture of me one time.
I did. Thank you.
So just is that kind of your way of trying to help promote, Melinda?
Well, I've always liked the promotion kind of thing. I'm a very visual person. And when the book came out, actually, they put it on Amazon. We weren't ready, but Amazon was ready. So we just went forward, and we thought we'd have a book signing launching via Facebook and Zoom. And that was a really good thing to do, because now we have 2.2K.
Yeah. 2,200 views of that Facebook live
and it's been
presentation.
Great. All the people that's reaching out from all over the United States to talk about the book, and people that we don't even know, and they will say we got the book, and sending pictures of them with the book, and it's amazing.
Yeah,
it's a lot of healing in this book, and especially now during the time of COVID. when we some of us think we can't make it. Well, if you read the stories of the veterans in war, man, we are just, this is like a little piece of the pie, because what they went through will give you so much courage and hope to get through this.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, speaking of healing, and something that I wanted to ask you about and that I really appreciate about your work, Ken, with the Remembering America's Heroes and also with this book is, you know, and that I think is particularly relevant to some things, conversations nationally that have been happening this year, but highlighting, you know, veterans of color and that is something that comes through in your work, because veterans and folks that have served do, you know, are of all genders, all races, all different backgrounds. You know, there's no just like mold for a veteran, right? And I think that's really cool to kind of get your hands around that a little bit and hear the different things that have motivated people from different cultures and different backgrounds to want to serve this country as well.
Yeah, that's I never intended or set out for this to the response the way it was. All I knew was that I taught at Milwaukee High, had become a very diverse high school, and something told me, you know, you to get all these kids to buy into this, we got to have people that look like them too here. And so I started reaching out to veterans, and I started learning. My learning curve took off. I didn't even know who the Tuskegee Airmen was. I didn't know much about the Navajo Code Talkers. And the Native American, the service rate of Native Americans in our military is phenomenal. No one comes close, and it's a huge pride thing. And then it's just meant so much. It meant so much to the students. It meant so much to those veterans. Many of them said that they'd never been acknowledged before, and they're honored on their reservation, and that's it. And so it's been such a blessing, and because of it, we've met so many amazing, wonderful people. Especially the cover of Volume 1 is an amazing cover with the Native Americans surrounding Frank Buckles, and my wife designed the cover for book one too. So,
yeah, awesome. Well, let's talk about Frank a little bit. As you mentioned, he was the last surviving World War One vet. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, I go into it in a lot of detail in the book, but I can tell you that he was such a remarkable, amazing man. He learned to speak several languages. He got involved in the shipping industry after World War One and traveled the world, and it was in Germany when Hitler came to power, and then he was in the Philippines, and it's remarkable and inspiring, and the messages of hope and overcoming, and it's just there, like Melinda said, there's so, not just in his chapter, but so many, there's so many things that are that we could use today and realize, my gosh, those people grew up during the Great Depression, and you hear the stories of how difficult that was for a lot of those families, and then they go to a whole world at war, and that, you know, they're all that, you'll get through it, you can get through it, you can make it, and that was, you know, he's just such a remarkable man, and people that are reading it are responding, says, my gosh, he was something else. So people are going to have to get that book and read it.
Okay, well, yeah, we don't want to give too much away. I do love, Melinda, you always kind of talk about him being, obviously, he was amazing, you know, one of our nation's heroes, but you have talked in the past offline just about some of his quirks and what a character he was.
Uncle Frank?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. He was amazing, and he was such a gentleman. He's not from England, but I could compare it to that, a gentleman as in a Englishman gentleman. He spoke so many different languages, and I just recently come from Germany,
And he actually wanted to speak in German, and I thought that was really cute because he, at that time, he had to probably be 100, maybe 100 years old. He passed away at 110, but he had so much charisma and was always ready to talk to you about anything. It's amazing.
Memory was
phenomenal. I have one memory. It's not in the book, I don't think. I'm not sure. But
you have to read it to find out.
He was 110. Was that his
100? When he passed, yes.
When he passed. But there was a birthday that I couldn't go.
109,
okay.
Because I went to it.
And so he would always ask, where is your wife? And he'd say, I'd like to have a toast now. You know, that kind of thing. And it was just great. I'd never been in anyone in that kind of company. And it was just great going to visit him. But this particular year, Ken had his iPad. And he put me on the iPad so I could sing happy birthday to him. And he didn't know what a computer was because he's not into computers. It wasn't his thing.
Yeah.
And when he saw me, he was trying to reach at the computer, and he kept asking Ken, why is she there? How did she get there? And then when I started singing, he just stared at it like, I don't understand, but it's beautiful.
Wow. But I remember when it was over, he was just shaking his head, and he just said, that's just something else. The technology changes I've seen in my lifetime.
Yes.
Oh, sure.
Really?
Absolutely. Well, the last thing that I wanted to ask you about is, you know, kind of sad, I guess, but it's something I think about a lot, you know, in my work outside of the Canby Curran and now here this Canby. I work with veterans a lot as well, and we are coming to, you know, inexorably toward a time where we're losing our World War II vets. And that generation is vanishing at an alarming rate. 5 years ago, we had over 17,000 World War II veterans in Oregon. As of this year, it is less than 3,000. So, and that's just in 5 years. So, I imagine that that's something that you think about a lot as well, Ken, and is a big part of your work and probably a big reason that this first volume and first two volumes focus a lot on World War II veterans, recording those stories and hearing from these guys before it's too late.
And it's not just World War II. Korean War veterans are going at just as fast a pace as the World War II, because many of them served in World War II. This is what's shocking. The Vietnam veterans are going at a faster rate than both Korea and World War II because of Agent Orange cancer.
Right.
It's so sad and tragic, but you're right. What's phenomenal from a historical standpoint is that you have three generations of war veterans back to back to back, and hopefully our country will never see anything like that again, although we've sent our young men and women off to harm's way and oh, the troubles that they're having, you know, trying to come get over all that. But a Marine Corps major who served in Iraq that lives in Oregon told me that it's so important to record these stories because when a veteran dies, it's like a whole library burning down. And it's true, you know, interviewing and getting to know these veterans and their stories, and I start with them in childhood, and it's just phenomenal. There's so many incredible stories, and you think, my gosh, these are just the ones I know here in Oregon and handfuls around the country. They're everywhere. They're in every community, and they're such treasures. They have so much to offer us. We can learn so much from them today.
Absolutely. Well, Ken and Melinda, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your work recording and bringing to greater bringing all of those stories to greater light, both for our young people and students and just for the world in general, helping record those for posterity's sake. And thanks for telling us all about it here on the show today. Is there anything that else that you'd like to add? Obviously, I should give you a chance to tell us where we can find your book.
Yes, right now it's available on Amazon, and you just do a go to the Amazon sites and look for books and then type in Remembrance Volume 1. One is a capital I. Frank Cutsworth at Cutsworth Thriftway is going to let us do a big book signing Saturday, November 10th at 11. Hmm. And so we're excited because there's a lot of local people and even people from around Portland that are going to drive down and want me to sign a book. So I said, okay, I'm an author now, so I have to sign. So excited about that. And then the last thing I'd like to say is that it was about, it was over 15 years ago, a World War II Marine from Iwo Jima and then again at the Chosin Reservoir in Korea told me that, Ken, the best thing you ever did for your program was to bring Melinda on board. And she has been such a blessing and so supportive. I've known this as a coach. To be a successful football coach, you have to have a great supportive wife. And there's a high divorce rate in that field. But my wife has been amazing. I've been very lucky and fortunate. Thank you. Thank you, honey.
You're welcome.
Thank you both.
So we have a little extra treat for you today. This is, we like over the years go to retirement homes and do the number one song during the era of war and a little trivia and sing it. And then when we did the research for World War II, we found that this was overwhelmingly, this was number one to all the troops as they left overseas and left their loved one, their wife or girlfriend or parents. And every time we've sang it at the, or not, Melinda sings it, these people get choked up. So here it is, I'll Be Seeing You.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park along the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut tree, the wishing well. I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun and when the night is new. I'll be looking at the moon and I'll be seeing you.
Wow. Thank you so much, Melinda, for that beautiful and sad song. Very sad.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for this opportunity for both of us. We really appreciate it.
Of course. We'll have you on again sometime. Maybe get you to sing next time. Okay. Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate and we got in a carriage ride with the horse and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life. Mm-hmm.
How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
All right, friends, we're going to draw this episode of the Can Be Current to a close with another edition of Can Be Then. And this version of Can Be Then is brought to you by The Book Nook, Canby's amazing local bookstore and gift shop. It's your source for new and used books, comic books, audiobooks, vintage books, children's books, business books, you get the idea. It's all things books across from the Backstop in downtown Canby. And if you heard the show or the story at the top of the show, they're going to be moving soon across the street to the old Parsons building. So good for them. We love you, The Book Nook. All right, it's Halloween. A time when the leaves change and the wind turns colder. A time when the nights grow longer and darker. A time when perhaps the veil that divides this world from the one beyond is just a little bit thinner. Well, not really. Not in Canby, anyway. We scoured our historical records looking for juicy stories of haunted houses, gruesome crimes, unexplainable phenomenon, you know, the usual stuff, and didn't find all that much. Nevertheless, we have compiled the best Halloween happenings from the history of Canby and the surrounding area, which we will share with you now. Our first story comes from Halloween night, 1921. According to an account in the Oregonian, Canby's night patrolman, Officer Reichenberg, was out rounding up hobos, which was apparently a big problem in the 1920s. As the newspaper recounted, Reichenberg had locked 2 hobos up in the jail and was hunting for 2 others who had been ordered out of the city but had refused to leave. The patrolman followed the suspects into a store but made a crucial error. He left his loaded rifle leaning against a wall outside. In a small, quiet town like Canby, that might have been okay on most nights, but not on Halloween. A group of local boys who are out for a big time happened by and noticed the rifle, just begging for a little bit of mischief. Taking advantage of a rare opportunity to fight the law and win, the boys made off with the firearm. 10 years later, a mysterious episode transpired on the eve of Halloween. Truman Northup, a Portland salesman who had evidently failed to learn the lesson of never picking up a hitchhiker on the eve of Halloween, stopped to pick up a hitchhiker near Newburgh. In his defense, Northup was only doing the chivalrous thing. You see, the hitchhiker was a young woman, alone, who seemed to be in the need of help. As it turned out, she could handle herself. Just imagine old Truman's shock when the seemingly vulnerable young lady pulled out a revolver, pointed it at him, and demanded to be taken to the Stafford area just north of Canby. The incident touched off a police search for the woman, but they were too late. Later that afternoon, a woman matching that description and dressed similarly, wearing khaki pants, a dark sweater, and a man's hat, checked into a hotel near Oregon City. The clerk at the Electric Hotel said the woman was limping noticeably and appeared very tired. After waiting in the hotel lobby for about 30 minutes, a man with a heavy beard arrived and took her away. The mysterious pair was never heard from again. The call that came in on the cold night in 1951 surely sounded like a prank call. A beaver is hanging about the Swank Hardware Store, the voice on the phone said. Are you sure it isn't pink with big ears and a curly tail on each end? Said the incredulous Officer Lamont Lucas. I'm not drunk, and it's a beaver, not an elephant, the voice insisted. Well, sure enough, that's exactly what it was. Apparently attracted by the bright lights of Canby, or maybe just looking for a night on the town, Oregon's favorite mammal was found trundling through the streets of downtown. Officer Lucas, having had little experience with beavers on the hoof, didn't know just how to handle this one, so he opened the door of the police car, invited him to go for a ride, the Oregonian later chronicled. With a little polite shooing to help him make up his mind, the fur-coated vagrant climbed in and sat down. In typical fashion, the vagabond was carted out of town and told to get moving. Taking the hint, he climbed down and ambled his way down the banks of the Pudding River. And around Halloween of 1957, Canby High School teacher and wrestling coach Jack Hollister heard some strange sounds coming from his front porch, but it wasn't trick-or-treaters. It was a burlap bag soaked in oil and burning quite merrily. Fortunately, the bag was empty, and Hollister was able to extinguish the blaze himself without the assistance from the fire district. The incident was an escalation in a continuing series of pranks and troublemaking between Canby and Malala Youths, which had been raging in the run-up to the annual football game between the two rival schools. Sadly, newspapers record that Canby was the instigator in the feud, as the first incident reported was the burning of a giant C on the lawn of Malala High School. Someone had also painted the word Canby on the sidewalk. The Malalans retaliated by burning an M in front of Canby High, then taking a, quote, noise-making tour around the city, most of it under the watchful eyes of on-duty police officers. One of the cars was pulled over after reports came in that the boys were shooting guns. However, a search of the vehicle by Officer Wayne Watson revealed no firearms, only 5 lengths of rubber hose into which a 410-gauge shotgun shell had been forced. I don't understand it either. The final injustice was the painting of the word Malala across the entrances of the high schools in Oregon City and West Lynn. After questioning dozens of high school boys from Canby and Malala, police developed 2 theories as to the perpetrators of this dastardly deed. One was that the Malala High School boys had done it, a reporter later wrote. The other was that Canby youths were the painters, inspired by a desire to give a black eye to the neighborly rivals. Well, finally, we'll leave you with one bona fide ghost story. What is the most haunted place in Canby? Well, it might just be the 100-year-old Route 99 Roadhouse located just outside of town. It's been known by many names, the Spinning Wheels, the Double Ought Ranch, W's. For years, its owners and employees have reported a strange feeling of not being alone. They have heard the sounds of footsteps and music upstairs, a space that was empty, or should be empty. The country restaurant and good old boys haunt has been rumored to have been a brothel in the early 20th century. Our history sleuths could find no proof of this, but then again, that wouldn't be something you would want to keep quiet. It's said that no less than 3 deaths have occurred at the property over the years. One was the owner, who committed suicide in the upstairs residence in which he lived. Another was supposedly one of the working girls who once called the place home. She was murdered by a customer, or so the legend goes. Now her spirits call the place home forevermore. All right, friends. Well, that does it for this edition of the Canby Current. Thank you so much for listening, and as always, have a great day.
Hey, Frankie, you okay? You seem kind of down.
Yeah, just bummed. Miss going to the Wild Hare. I know you can still get takeout and all, but it's just not the same.
Well, you know they're open again, right?
What?
Yeah, they've been open for a while now. Don't you cover, like, the news?
Hey, I'm only human, okay?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that the Wild Hare and their amazing staff are thrilled to be open again for delicious meals and fun times. They are strictly following all the recommended safety guidelines, and they have the only covered outdoor patio in Canby, with lots of tables spaced 6 feet apart and umbrellas also spaced 6 feet apart, and fantastic ambiance. And hey, if you're still more comfortable with carryout, they can hook you up there too. Find their menu and other information online at thewildhairsaloon.net or check them out in Canby and Oregon City. Anything to add, Frankie? Frankie? Oh, I guess he left. God, he must have been really hungry. Now Hear This Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.